is the news.
Headlines: the Yemeni army conducts a warning strike to stop the illegal shipping of Yemeni oil by the Saudi-led coalition. The Taliban say they've killed several Daesh operatives who were involved in a recent bloody attack on a female school. Plus, China wraps up the Communist Party Congress with a resolution confirming the core status of President Xi Jinping. Welcome to World News from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you for joining us. Now, top story. Yemen's army says it has carried out a drone attack on a southern oil port to warn the Saudi-led coalition against the plundering the country's resources. The army spokesman says what he called the basic warning strike was aimed at preventing a tanker from looting Yemeni crude through an oil terminal in Hadramaut province. Yahya Sari' says the vessel violated a ban on the transfer and export of Yemeni oil products. He also vowed more such strikes to prevent the plunder of the country's oil wealth. This is the first such incident since a UN brokered truce between Yemen's Ansarullah resistance movement and the Saudi-led coalition came to an end earlier this month. The coalition launched a devastating war on Yemen in 2015. Our correspondent Yusuf Mowry says the Saudi-led coalition keeps plundering Yemen's oil wealth despite an agreement signed to settle the issue.
Well, yeah, the peace agreement basically ended military activities on paper. However, you still have much of Yemen's natural resources being looted by foreign nations under the government, most of which reside in Europe, and they're basically selling the natural resources, gas and oil, below international market price, and they're basically, these corrupt officials are making money under the table. And the message being delivered here by the Sana'a government is, enough is enough, the game is over, no longer will Yemen allow its natural resources to be looted by foreign nations because of corrupt government officials being backed by Saudi Arabia and a Saudi-led coalition. And this is why the Sana'a government launched these two bomb-driven drones which targeted the terminal in the port of Adaba to basically send a message that if this Greek oil ship loads any oil or gas resources onto the ship, it's going to be targeted.
All five Iranian crew members of a Venezuelan cargo plane that was grounded in Argentina back in June have arrived in Caracas. They are among 19 crew members of a Boeing 747 cargo plane grounded over alleged violation of U.S. sanctions. Venezuela's transport minister has expressed happiness over the freedom of all crew members who he said were kidnapped by the Argentine judiciary. Argentina's judiciary, the plane had been sold by Iran's Mahan Air to Venezuelan airline Amitrasur, both sanctioned by the U.S. The aircraft carrying auto parts landed in the Argentine capital en route from Mexico on June 6. It was not permitted to refuel in Argentina, where authorities detained its crew on the request of a U.S. court. An Argentinian judge recently said the documents provided by the plaintiff were insufficient and invalid. Iran rejects Western allegations of transferring drones to Russia for the use in the Ukraine war and condemns what it sees as Europe's provocations over the issue. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani called the provocations destructive, saying Iran reserves the right to respond to any irresponsible move. He reiterated Iran's stance on supporting an immediate end to the Ukraine war through a political process. On Friday, the UK, Germany and France called on the UN to investigate the transfer of Iranian-made drones to Russia. They said the transfer violates a UN resolution that endorsed the 2015 Iran deal. Kanani said the trio is seeking to link its baseless allegations to that resolution in line with its unlawful measures against Iran. He also condemned the EU and Britain for their recent sanctions on Tehran over the same allegations. Russia has already denied using Iranian drones in Ukraine. The Taliban say they have killed the 6 Daesh members in an overnight operation in the Afghan capital, Kabul. According to the Taliban, the terrorists were involved in 2 major attacks in recent weeks. Both occurred in Kabul. One took place on September 30. It hit a girls' school, killing 53 people, most of them female students. The other occurred a week earlier. It hit a mosque, killing 7 people and injuring over 40. A series of explosions have rocked different Afghan cities, mostly the capital, since the Taliban took over the country in August 2021. Most of the attacks were claimed by Daesh. China's Communist Party has approved amendments to its charter endorsing President Xi Jinping's, quote, core leadership. Hours ago, the party unanimously passed a resolution on the changes as it concluded its 20th National Congress. It introduced a new central committee of around 200 senior party officials. The committee is expected to keep Xi as the party's general secretary when it meets on Sunday. That would pave the way for him to gain a third term as China's president in March, when the government's annual legislative sessions are held. Some 2,300 delegates of the Communist Party attended the week-long Congress, which is held twice a decade. Political commentator Andrew Leong says during Xi Jinping's presidency, China has gained significant achievements in terms of both economic growth and global influence.
Well, if you look at the Western media, they're all zeroing in on Xi's apparent grab on power and also more aggressiveness in the international arena. Continuing blackening China without paying any attention that the bulk of the party congress is about China's domestic governance, which is the pride of the Communist Party, because under the Communist Party, the lives of the Chinese people have changed miraculously and over the past decades, especially under President Xi. The economy has grown, the GDP per capita has doubled, and China's influence is growing around the world. So there is no wonder that there is a considerable consensus, even though there are necessarily some dissenting voices, but they are in the minor minority. So the consensus in the party is that Xi is the man to take China to a higher plane. Higher plane meaning another milestone in realizing the China dream of becoming a modern socialist country by the year 2035.
Italy's far-right firebrand Giorgia Meloni has been sworn in as the country's first female prime minister almost a month after the parliamentary election. Meloni, alongside her 24-member cabinet, took the oath of office during a ceremony at the presidential palace. 5 of the ministers are technocrats, not representing any party, while 6 others are women. Meloni's Brothers of Italy party swept to victory in the election as part of a coalition that included Forza Italia of former Premier Silvio Berlusconi and Matteo Salvini's League. She announced her cabinet after weeks of negotiations with allies. However, the new administration has challenging tasks ahead as the country is grappling with issues ranging from high inflation and energy prices to relations with European partners. Italy is expecting a €21 billion COVID recovery package, which Meloni wants to renegotiate. Joining us is Max Civili, our correspondent in Rome. Max, is there any indication that the events that we're seeing in Ukraine, which have resulted in an energy crisis in Europe, is bringing governments down one by one, as we are seeing in Italy, and the rise of the far right?
Well, let me start by saying that government collapsing is quite a common thing in Italy. Since the 1948, since Italy became a republic, so in about 74 years, Italy has had 68 governments, averaging almost one government a year. Having said that, what do we have to expect from the Meloni government? She's no longer the Meloni who, back in 2016, said that the EU is rotten to the core, and the Meloni who was opposing the sanctions against Russia for the annexation of Crimea. She is now a pro-NATO, pro-EU leader, and her government will be a pro-NATO, a pro-EU leader. At least this is what she has repeatedly said over the past weeks. Now, if you have a look at her lies, I wouldn't be 100% sure about the posture the Italian government will hold in the coming months over the Ukraine conflict. Why? Because two of her major supporters, Silvio Berlusconi and Matteo Salvini, have been sympathetic to Putin over the past years, particularly Silvio Berlusconi, the leader of Forza Italia, the Forza Italia party, was portrayed in a video clip a few days ago in which he clearly said that the president of Ukraine, Volodymyr Zelensky, should be held accountable for the conflict in Ukraine. And he also clearly said that Vladimir Putin is one of his closest and dearest friends. What is going to happen in the coming weeks is to me clear that Meloni will say that her government will be a pro-NATO and pro-EU executive. But let's see what Berlusconi and Salvini will have to say on the government's international posture.
Max, thank you very much indeed for that. Max Civili there, our correspondent, joining us from the Italian capital, Rome. A new survey has found millions of households in Britain are skipping meals as they struggle with the country's deepening cost of living crisis. The findings show inflation returns to a 40-year high after food prices soar. Saeed Poureza reports from London.
It's been just a few weeks since the now resigned Prime Minister, Liz Truss, promised low taxes and high growth. Events have moved incredibly fast in Westminster that a new finance minister is now raising taxes and promising public sector cuts. The U-turns and counter-U-turns have come with a cost for the economy and the people. A new study has found that millions of households are skipping meals or struggling to put healthy foods on the table. Inflation is already at more than 10%. Energy and fuel prices are on the rise, putting a squeeze on Britain's finances.
Well, the start of all this is Brexit. Brexit led to Boris and incompetence. It led to falling living standards. It led to Liz Truss and further incompetence. And Britain basically voted to become poorer by leaving the EU. You can blame some of it on money printing at the Bank of England, inflation taking out, you know, and lowering living standards as well. So it's a combination of things.
A combination of things that have toppled two prime ministers in the span of 1 year.
It's been less than 2 months since Boris Johnson gave way to Liz Truss as prime minister, followed by the death of the Queen and a dramatic change in the country's economic outlook. And now, yet another leadership contest that could trigger even more economic and political instability.
And more instability means more people relying on charities, from food banks to keep their stomachs full, and warm rooms where those unable to heat their homes can take refuge in the cold months of winter. The new chancellor has curbed Liz Truss's flagship economic plan of a two-year cap on energy bills to April next year. And at the end of this month, he's expected to announce a midterm economic policy that could spell out the beginning of another prolonged period of austerity.
Whoever takes over, Boris, Rishi, Mordaunt, who knows? But the outlook continues to be bad because inflation is still out of control. There's not the money or the government finances to give the public sector further wage rises to match that inflation. Strikes will continue. The fiscal position of the country remains dire, partly because we have a smaller economy because of Brexit. So there's no easy solution. There's no easy way out of this. The hole has been dug, and it's very deep and very difficult to climb out of.
Paying the price of that, ordinary Britons, as the Conservative Party races to choose its third leader and prime minister in 1 year, urgent help to those in need couldn't come any sooner. Saeed Purisa, London.
Conservative British lawmakers are declaring who they're backing to become the party leader and next prime minister after Liz Truss's resignation left the position up for grabs. So far, former Prime Minister Boris Johnson and his former finance minister Rishi Sunak are leading the race with the most backing from MPs. Many British politicians doubt that Johnson will receive the 100 nominations he needs from lawmakers to run for the position. They are citing a lack of confidence in Johnson as his recent premiership was blighted with scandals and allegations of misconduct. Penny Mordaunt, who is popular with party members, is the only one to formally declare her candidacy for the Tory leadership so far. Liz Truss quit on Thursday after only 6 weeks in office. There were growing calls for her to resign over a host of issues, including her controversial economic package. Well, that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Virtues of the Believers, Friday the 3rd of Ramadan, 1394, the 20th of September, 1974. If God wishes to grant forgiveness to someone, this means healing the wound he inflicted on his own soul through sinning. So these true believers are those whose spiritual wounds God will heal, forgiveness in a noble provision. They shall have a provision without any abasement or humiliation, without any difficulty or grief. This is the kind of provision God will grant them. Whenever a faithful society comes into being, I am not talking about an individual, so do not say, thank God we have a morsel of bread to eat, so we are okay, we have no grief. Because when you really examine such a person's behavior, you see it is all misfortune and mistreatment of others. They do degrading work and they don't even see that what they do is degrading, or that this morsel of bread they have is a morsel of humiliation. I am talking about a society. When a society's morsel of bread is clean, when it is noble, when it is earned with dignity, This is when its provision is noble and distinguished, and this happens when a society is truly faithful and displays the qualities I am describing. If this was the case, all of the slogans that political parties in the world today are loudly proclaiming from every quarter to every people, whether truly or falsely, in order to win votes, all of these slogans and promises could be achieved in a truly faithful society. Peace, freedom, prosperity, and ease, achieved without war, without bloodshed, through fraternity, through friendship, a high level of culture, a high level of prosperity, and a high level of living, all of these slogans and mottos, some of which are meaningful, others of which are meaningless, all of them would be actually achieved in a faithful society and a noble provision.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Faith based on understanding. Saturday, the 4th of Ramadan, 1394, 21st of September, 1974. Indeed, in the creation of the heavens and the earth and the alternation of night and day, there are signs for those who possess intellect. Those who remember Allah standing, sitting, and lying on their sides, and reflect on the creation of the heavens and the earth, and say, "Our Lord, you have not created this in vain. Immaculate are you. Save us from the punishment of the fire." Surah Ali Imran, Surah number 3, verses 190 and 191. Today we will look at a few more verses on the topic of faith. There are a few points we must consider. Firstly, faith is one of the foremost qualities of God's prophets and the true believers who follow them. They have faith in their own message. This is the difference between divine leaders and the political leaders of today's world.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
On the last day of September, Burkina Faso military leader President Paul Henri Damiba was deposed in the country's second coup in a year as Army Captain Ibrahim Traore took charge of the restive West African nation. Now, the coup was welcomed by many in the streets of the country's capital, Ouagadougou.
We are in the streets not because we support a coup or encourage it, but to find unity and truth. We are here to support our military, to find peace, because we have suffered so much at the hands of terrorists.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of news and events making headlines in Africa. Today we are focusing on the recent coup in Burkina Faso, which came amid an upsurge of terrorist attacks. The people of Burkina Faso, just like many in neighboring West African countries, believe that former colonial power France is responsible for the current insecurity across the region. Our expert will be giving us her take on the reasons for the coup in Burkina Faso. The second part of our program today will be on condescending remarks by the United States climate envoy John Kerry, who is demanding that African countries should not invest in long-term gas projects.
The struggle in Burkina Faso. Burkina Faso Army Captain Ibrahim Traoré has ousted military leader Lieutenant Colonel Paul Henri Damiba in what marks the second coup in the West African country this year. According to a statement read on national TV on 30th of September, Traoré and a group of officers deposed Damiba, dissolved the government, and suspended the constitution and transitional charter.
Traoré said the officers who helped Damiba seize power in January had decided to remove their leader due to his inability to deal with the insurgent groups, including some associated with Al-Qaeda and Daesh. A Burkina Faso military spokesman is seen here making the coup announcement.
Our common ideal was betrayed by our leader, Lieutenant Colonel Paul Henri Damiba, in whom we had placed all our trust. Indeed, the deterioration of the security situation, which justified our action, has been relegated to the background in favor of unfortunate political adventures.
Well, to discuss the recent military coup in Burkina Faso, we contacted Ms. Inem Richardson. She's an organizer with All African People's Revolutionary Party. She's also the co-founder of the Thomas Sankara Center for African Liberation and Unity. Thanks a lot, madam, for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm always happy to be on.
Now, what really led to the latest coup in Burkina Faso just months after another military takeover?
Well, I think if we look at the context behind this coup and the last one, we see that the original coup against Damiba was actually quite popular at first. People came out largely in support of it, because the hope was that Damiba would follow the direction that Mali took and divorce Burkina Faso from France and French domination, as well as from Western control in general. That was very much the desire of the people on the ground and why people wanted the coup in the first place. After a long period of time, people began to see that there was not much of a difference in terms of how France's relationship with Burkina Faso materialized or existed on the ground, as well as how the Damiba administration was approaching the security situation in the Sahel region and the border region with Mali. So there was an increased, over time, discontent with Damiba.
The dramatic takeover, which ended with ousted military leader fleeing to neighboring Togo, coincided with violent anti-French protests and the sudden emergence of Russian flags among demonstrators. The army officers who seized power in Burkina Faso say toppled military leader Paul Henri Damiba is planning a counter-offensive from a French base. Protesters have come out in support of the new military leader, while condemning the ousted ruler, who they accused of being a puppet of France.
Damiba is pro-French. He has destroyed Burkina Faso. But thanks to God, we have a great strong man like Ibrahim Traoré to save us all.
Protesters in Burkina Faso have openly expressed support for Russia. Burkina Faso is now turning into a theater of struggle for control between Russia and France and the West in general.
I think, you know, Burkina Faso and this whole region of the Sahel in general is beyond a theater of struggle between Russia and the West. I think this is also a region where there's a heightened dissatisfaction with a long neocolonial system that has been run by France and French allies like the United States and the other NATO countries for a very, very long time. So we see not just here in Burkina Faso, but also we mentioned Mali, but we can talk about Chad. We can talk about protests in Niger. We can even talk about protests in Senegal. We see this whole movement trying to get France out of the Sahel.
Now, we have seen protesters expressing displeasure with the regional bloc ECOWAS after military takeovers in West Africa. Now, is ECOWAS realistic in its approach to coups in the region?
You know, I think that there's a lot of hypocrisy within ECOWAS right now. You know, we understand that the goal of ECOWAS and what it promotes are what they claim to be free and fair elections, a certain style of democracy that is encouraged in the region. But we also see some of these people who are taking the most anti-coup stances, like out of Senegal and out of Cote d'Ivoire, for example, who are also constantly under surveillance by the people themselves because of this constant threat of taking illegal third mandates, unconstitutional third mandates to stay in power and to prolong their own positions. So there's kind of this hypocrisy where, on the one hand, ECOWAS is very pro sort of this Western style bourgeois democracy, but on the other hand, also violates that whenever it's convenient for certain neo-colonial factors to stay in power. What is really damaging on ECOWAS's part are when the sanctions are issued in cases like what happened against Mali, because that's not even just targeting the Malian government, that's hurting the people.
The recent events in Burkina Faso are almost similar to what happened in neighboring Mali, where anti-French sentiments run high. The government in Mali believes France is still interfering in the internal affairs of this country, including backing terrorist groups.
I really encourage everybody who is listening to this to go and listen to what Prime Minister Maiga said at the United Nations General Assembly. The accusations against France by the Malian authorities are really quite grave, really quite serious. Beyond just supporting the former president of Mali, we are hearing about the violation of Malian airspace with drones and fighter jets. We are hearing accusations that France has supplied terrorist organizations with arms and ammunition, as well as intelligence information. There was support on France's part of ECOWAS sanctions against Mali as a result of the anti-French government that's currently in power and currently sees power.
According to the Global Terrorism Index 2022, the Sahel is home to the world's fastest growing and most deadly terrorist groups. Now, how will the instability in Burkina Faso impact on the regional struggle against terrorism in the wider Sahel region?
Well, I think more and more people are understanding that this question of terrorism and this question of neocolonialism are not separate questions, but we have to understand what the roots are of terrorist activity is in this region of the world. I already mentioned the way that the NATO invasion of Libya impacted the Sahel. That led to a huge availability of arms flowing into the direction of the Sahel region. And this is something that people are increasingly aware of. And then, you know, we are talking about the role of France in also helping to sustain some of this terrorist activity, according to what the Malian authorities are currently alleging. And so I think that, you know, there's different ways to look at this question. Stability, we see this as typically a positive thing, but we have to understand that, you know, stability is not always necessarily positive. If it's necessary to disrupt the system that exists a little bit for a period of time, if that means some form of instability, as long as we can bring that to a place of organization and to a popular form of government, then that's welcome. But what's not welcome is a very stable, long-term neo-colonial system that completely exploits the African people for the benefit of France and for the benefit of Europe.
Well, our guest there says instability, which ushers in a popular government, is preferable than a stable neo-colonial system. I'd like to thank Inem Richardson for her incisive analysis today. We shall now take a short break before our next topic, which is on the patronizing remarks by the U.S. climate envoy, which angered many in Africa. Stay with us.
Kerry angers Africa. Thank you.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
United States climate envoy John Kerry has angered many in Africa after arrogantly stating that African countries should not invest in long-term gas projects in the continent. Speaking on the sidelines of an African government ministers conference in Dakar, Senegal last month, Kerry claimed the world is transitioning to renewable energy and that will not be in the interest of Africa investing in gas projects.
Gas replaces coal or replaces oil. That's good. But after 2030, it's going to be important to be able to capture the emissions from gas, too.
Now, to discuss these annoying remarks by John Kerry, we have contacted Tunde Osazua, who is an African team member of the Black Alliance for Peace. Thanks a lot, sir, for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Now, can we say the assertion by Kerry that Africa should not invest in long-term gas projects is condescending and imperialistic?
I think so. Especially since Kerry is representing the U.S. imperialist state. U.S. imperialism is the greatest threat to life on the planet. It's the force of ecological devastation and disaster. It impacts not only human beings, but also our non-human neighbors and relatives. In fact, you know, the U.S. military is the largest force of ecological devastation that the world has ever known. It's, you know, been robbed through atomic bombs, toxic waste, and untreated sewage that's been dumped by over 800 military bases in over 80 countries. The U.S. Department of Defense actually consumes more oil than any institution in the world. And in the year 2017 alone, the U.S. military emitted 59 million metric tons of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, which is a carbon footprint greater than of most nations worldwide.
Mohammed Ibrahim, a leading African philanthropist, accused developed countries of hypocrisy in warning Africans against developing natural gas reserves while also eyeing such investments in response to the energy crisis in Europe.
Europe is wallowing in gas. Germany uses a lot of gas. Russian gas, actually half of African gas is exported to Europe. And then we have 600 million people without power. And people say, no. You cannot use gas here. This is morally bankrupt. It's just, that's immoral.
Many African analysts have echoed Mohammed Ibrahim's sentiments, saying efforts by Western powers to restrict fossil fuel investments in Africa are the height of hypocrisy.
It's the height of hypocrisy, those efforts to restrict fossil fuel investments in Africa, since many of the wealthy countries behind those efforts, like the United States, the United Kingdom, and France, include natural gas in their own multi-decade plans to transition to clean energy. Belgium, for example, has doubled its natural gas usage since 1990 and has plans to build even more gas-to-power capacity in the coming years.
While Africa has contributed negligibly to the changing climate with just about 2-3% of global emissions, it stands out disproportionately as the most vulnerable region in the world. Now, this is while, according to Carbon Brief's analysis, the United States is the highest contributor to cumulative carbon dioxide emissions in the world since 1850. Now, Kerry denied that the West and developed nations bear responsibility for climate change and urged every country to bear the burden of its impacts. How true is this statement?
It's not very true. The African continent and much of the third world is already bearing the brunt of climate change, while much of the West, you know, is relatively protected in some cases, right? And the African continent hardly produces any greenhouse gases, despite all of that. African people and Africa's non-human inhabitants are paying a heavy price for the environmental crimes of foreign lands like the U.S., like, you know, France and the U.K. and Japan and others. One resident of the United States has the same climate footprint as 27.5 Senegalese people.
The West is insisting that Africa forgoes the gas, oil, and coal at its disposal due to climate change. Uganda President Yoweri Museveni, speaking recently at the country's independence celebrations, slammed European Union Parliament for demanding that the country should halt its East Africa crude oil pipeline project.
Recently, there was yet another manifestation of imperialistic arrogance and hegemonism by elements in the European Parliament, whereby they decreed from Brussels that East African crude pipeline should not be constructed until those arrogant actors permit us to do so.
The insistence by U.S. climate envoy John Kerry and the EU Parliament that African countries should halt their fossil fuel development projects is seen by many as a deliberate attempt by Western countries to prevent Africa's industrialization, which will eventually stop over-reliance to the West.
I think we should note that it's not just industrialization that caused climate change. It's really the extractive practices of multinational corporations, largely based in the West, and the devastation of, you know, Western militaries, and particularly those like the U.S. military that brought about climate change. And so the false narrative that, you know, the West is trying to push helps them argue that Africa and a lot of the third world should forgo industrialization. And that's basically a death sentence for African countries.
Delegates from over 50 countries participated in a pre-COP27 meeting held in Kinshasa, the capital city of the Democratic Republic of Congo. Climate activists praised the progress made and want to make sure that previous promises are kept. The country's environment minister said that Africa must be allowed to exploit its resources.
The 2022 United Nations Climate Change Conference, more commonly referred to as the COP27 Summit, will be held at Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, in November. Now, what's your projection on this meeting? Are we going to see major split between the West and Africa?
And the success of that domination has always depended on the complicity of an intermediate class of the colonized. Those forces represent a central pillar of the colonial order. They're really just servants to, you know, their imperialists or neocolonial masters. And so for that to change, there has to be some sort of serious class struggle on the African continent against these servants we call, you know, heads of state and their contemporaries, the compradors, the African ruling class. And I think without that class struggle, there won't be a major split at the COP27 summit. There'll only be minor statements of grievance, like we're seeing, you know, today with certain folks kind of speaking out.
Now, Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni has expressed readiness to work with other willing partners in the country's oil pipeline project after the European Union expressed opposition to the development of the country's oil resources. Let's take a listen.
East Africans, therefore, should not worry about those arrogant people, that those arrogant people can stop the oil project in East Africa. If any actor tries to delay our project, we shall decisively deal with that betrayal according to the relevant laws. We shall develop all the aspects of the project with willing partners. Initially, I was not interested in the pipeline. I was only interested in the refinery to produce petrol, diesel, aviation fuel for East African market. It is Total who insisted, even when Uganda had to give away $20.7 per barrel to use the pipeline. In the end, we support the pipeline because it contributes something modest to our Tanzanian sisters and brothers who, under Mwalimu's leadership, contributed so much to Africa, including Uganda, in the anti-colonialism effort. Besides, the pipeline corridor provided by the Tanzanian government will bring to us gas from Tanzania and Mozambique because our gas resources are not that big. We need gas for fertilizer manufacture, to produce chemicals, etc. Therefore, down with the imperialist parasitic measures.
Now, what option do African countries have if Western oil multinationals and financial institutions withdraw from fossil energy projects in Africa?
Western oil multinationals and, you know, the international or Western financial institutions are largely responsible for the current climate catastrophe that Africa and much of the colonized world is experiencing. What African countries need is debt cancellation, they need debt cancellation and reparations for the decades, even, you know, centuries of work that these institutions and corporations have done to impoverish African people and intensify that climate catastrophe that they're facing at this moment on the African continent and really throughout the world.
Well, there you have it. Western colonial powers actually owe African countries billions of dollars for crimes they committed against African people over the past centuries. This is the money that Africa needs to develop and attain self-sufficiency. I'd like to thank our guest today, Tunde Osazua, for his incisive analysis. And that brings us to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. Goodbye for now.
What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio, we have a very special guest speaker from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Karimi. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. Welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Okay, Sheikh, for today's discussion, we want to be concerned with the concept of prevention of the prayer or making null and void the prayers based on Ayah 59 of Surah Maryam. If I want to refer to the English translation, it says, but they were succeeded by an evil posterity who neglected the prayer and followed their base appetites, so they will soon encounter the reward of perversity. Okay, the most important part and the core Vikansa's sentence or phrase in this ayah is neglecting the prayer. What does it mean by neglecting the prayer?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Actually, the word, the Arabic word used in this verse is ada'u salat, which comes from ida'a, and we have also tadri'ah in some of the narrations. The translator has translated it into neglecting, but yes. It's not, I mean...
Nullify can also be a good word.
Yeah, and I mean, ida'a and tadri'ah means to spoil something, yes. To ruin, to damage something.
Yes.
So when it comes to this word, there are, let me, before going to the viewpoints of the interpreters of the Noble Book of Quran, shares some narrations in this regard. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam is quoted as saying that this verse is referring, because the verse is talking about a posterity, an evil posterity who succeeded a group. So that righteous group is referring to some of the prophets among the children of Israel, Ben Israel. And this evil posterity who succeeded them, they were bad people in terms of neglecting or spoiling their prayer and following their vain desires. So according to Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, he says that ada'u salat means tarakuha aw akharuha an mawaqitaha. They abandoned the prayer, they didn't say the prayer, or they said the prayer but not on time.
That's right.
I will come to the interpretation of this part. And in another narration, the Holy Prophet is quoted as saying that as long as a Muslim, a human being, is careful about his five or her five daily prayers, Satan is away from him or her. But as soon as he or she does tadjiyah of the prayer, then it is very likely for him or her to be deceived by the Satan. I will come to this concept, of course.
Okay.
Imam Ali alayhi salam, in his letter to Muhammad ibn Abi Bakr, says that, know that, Ya Muhammad, kullu shay'un taba'un li salatik. Everything is a follower of your prayer, meaning that, man dayya'a as-salah fahuwa li ghayriha adya'. If you neglect the prayer, if you spoil your prayer, then it is more likely for you to spoil other obligations.
That's right.
So
all in all, salat and prayer over here, you know, is the pillar.
Exactly.
Is the
That's
pivot.
The point that I would like to come to, that according to the narrations, the most important pillar of the religion of Islam is prayer. And that is why, according to some narrations, in قُبِلَتْ قُبِلَ مَا سَوَاهَا, if the prayer is accepted, then other actions are accepted. And I've heard from some of the great scholars of mysticism that if you are, if it is likely for you to commit any kind of sin, okay, that's okay, you may do that, but do not abandon the prayer.
Mm-hmm.
Because as long as you are saying your prayer, there is a rope between you and God. You have not cut any relation between you and God.
That's right.
And there is a hope for you to come back and repent. But if you cut this rope, then it's very difficult for the people to come back to
and,
God.
Is it true that upon revealing this verse, this ayah of the Quran, the Holy Prophet said that 60 years after this event, there were some people who come who, for example, spoil the prayer, and it was exactly at the time of Imam al-Hussein or something like that?
There is one narration, as you rightly mentioned, from the Prophet, and this is one of the interpretations mentioned by the Shia scholars about the meaning of this verse, but the concept which is mentioned in this verse is not limited to those people. It can be applied to any person, any people, in any time and era.
Okay.
Now, having said that about the importance of the prayer, and let me just share one more narration in this regard that is very interesting.
Okay.
Imam Sadiq alayhi salam is quoted as saying, "Inna al-'abda idha salla liwaqtaha," when a servant says the prayer on time, وَحَافَظَ عَلَيْهَا اِرْتَفَعَتْ بَيْضَى نَقِيَّةً. The prayer goes up, spiritually speaking, to God, to the heaven, to Malakut, to that spiritual realm, in a white and pure way. And then that prayer says, addressing that person, Hafiztani Hafizakallah. You protected me, may God protect you. But وَإِذَا لَمْ يُصَلِّهَا لِوَقْتِهَا وَلَمْ يُحَافِظْ عَلَيْهَا. But if that person does not stay on time and does not protect the prayer, meaning that does not act upon the etiquette of the prayer, that prayer goes to God, to the heaven, in a black manner, and says, ضَيَّعْتَنِي ضَيَّعَكَ اللَّهِ. You ruined me, may God ruin you. Or you neglected me, may God neglect you. All in all, we have the concept of ida'a or tadyi'a of the prayer. As I mentioned, neglecting, ruining, spoiling, these are some of the translations.
That's right.
What is the meaning of that? According to some Shia scholars, based on the narrations, it means not to say the prayer on time. This is one understanding of the prayer. And according to some others, it means not saying the prayer at all. For me, it seems that...
Or for example, improper doing of doing the prayer. For example, fast, you know, incomplete fast recitation of the surahs, you know. And
I believe that what we can get from the books of Arabic dictionaries and also the books of interpretation of the Quran, ida'a or tadyi' means to destroy the form and order of an action. So if we say the prayer in a way that it doesn't bring about any positive result, it means that we have ruined the prayer. We have neglected the prayer. In some cases, it might be abandoning the prayer altogether.
Yes.
In some cases, as you rightly mentioned, it might be that we say the prayer in a very neglectful manner. We are not aware of what we are saying. In some cases, it might be not saying the prayer on time. So if we say the prayer, if we do not say the prayer, this is for sure the best example of, neglecting the prayer.
That's right.
If we say the prayer, but in a way that it doesn't bring any change in our life, it doesn't bring any spiritual effects in our life, again, it is a form of ida'at as-salah, spoiling and ruining the prayer.
That's right.
That is why we have different narrations in this regard. According to some, it's been interpreted as abandoning the prayer, and according to others, it is referring to not saying the prayer on time.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir. Inshallah, inshallah,
inshallah, you'll find your way. So, if you put together all the narrations, as I mentioned, ida'atu salat can be translated as saying the prayer in a way that it doesn't bring any positive result, any positive fruit for our life, for our spiritual life, or abandoning the prayer altogether.
In a beautiful story, we read that once a person was praying inside the mosque so fast, and Imam Ali alayhi salam witnessed such a scene and just give him the simile or the metaphor of as if you are pecking like a crow on a seed, okay? Referring to, we can say, how the birds collect the seeds in a fast manner. So do not like be a crow in your prayer or salat.
There are two more important points that I would like to share regarding this verse 59 of chapter Maryam. First of all, the verse reads, فَخَلَفَ مِنْ بَعْدِهِمْ خَلْفٌ أَضَاعُوا الصَّلَاةَ. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants to talk about the fact that this posterity were, an evil posterity. And the point that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is putting emphasis on is the fact that they neglected the prayer. So again, it is showing the importance of prayer of Salat, the fact that I referred to at the beginning of today's session. So the point that these people were an evil posterity is that they neglected the prayer. So again, another point mentioned in this verse regarding the significance of the prayer. And the next point is وَاتَّبَعُوا الشَّهَوَاتِ. So when it comes to this evil posterity, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala refers to two features: neglecting the prayer and following the vain desires. Now, according to some scholars, following the